resonators. In other words, there are circuits in there that favor a particular frequency. And once you've got a circuit that favors a particular frequency, you're about to find out what magic can happen. I'm now going to go to the most basic kind of a resonator we can all relate to. You're pushing a child on a swing. And if you've got a very efficient swing, it's got a real good set of ball bearings where the chain goes up to the top, to the pivot point, and it's not a windy day, and the child is a streamlined child, if you know what I mean, by with your finger pushing against the child, and you push at the, as the child approaches the bottom of the swinging, and you push with your finger a tiny little bit of force, maybe a small fraction of a pound, but you do it cyclically, and in a short period of time, you've got the child swinging back and forth, 45 degrees up and forward, and 45 degrees to the back, because you've done it in synchronism. You've done it at resonance. You've pushed at the right time. You could, with a little bit of care, use some kind of a metronome-like device and decide to push the child at a slightly higher frequency or a slightly lower frequency. Let's assume that the child swings back and forth once every 2 seconds. That happens to be the resonant frequency of that particular swing with that weight of child and that length of swing today, once every 2 seconds, and you push as the child goes through the bottom of the swinging motion. Once every 2 seconds, you push in synchronism, and you build up a very nice amount of energy. You now decide to run an experiment with your metronome where you push the child every 2.5 seconds instead of every 2 seconds, and pretty soon you'll start getting out of phase.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Pretty soon you'll start getting out of phase, because you're now pushing the child at a slightly different rate than the rate at which the child is swinging. A few cycles downrange, you'll be pushing the child forward while the child is swinging rearward through the bottom point, if you know what I mean. And you'll be pushing out of phase. Well, if you use the wrong frequency of pushes, even though you're using the exact same amount of force, pretty soon you'll realize that the amount of motion the child has is extremely small, and it might even go to zero, if you know what I mean. So, as you can tell, the so-called forcing function, that's what you're doing, versus the resonant function, that's what the swing in the child is doing, if they are synchronized, if the forcing function equals the resonant frequency, you can build up a whole lot of energy, and therefore, that becomes a kind of a filter. That's a filter that will filter out whether or not you're pushing at 2 cycles per second in my one push every 2 seconds in my particular example. So when you build an inductor and capacitor circuit and you adjust it to the resonant at 455 kilohertz, a very common frequency for IF strips of ordinary radios, AM radios in particular, a signal going down that IF strip that is at 455 KC, which is the tuned frequency of that set of networks in there, will build up a very nice signal. It flows through, and if the filter was properly designed, the insertion loss at that frequency might be 9/10, if you know what I mean. It's a passive network. It doesn't have gain, but the signal flows through almost the same amplitude as what went in, if the frequency is right. And now you go up the band from 455 KC, where the filter is tuned, you go 10 KC higher or 10 KC lower, and the response of the filter will be a very small fraction of what it is at resonant frequency. So the magic of resonance makes antennas work, makes filters work, makes a lot of things work. And so now how much quality is in your particular resonating network is what really counts. If you choose a good way of building the inductors and the capacitors that are making the filter network, making the individual resonators inside of your filter, you can get very high performance. The highest Q resonators that you can easily lay your hands on are quartz crystals. A properly designed quartz crystal as a resonating device can have a Q easily of 10,000 and maybe even 50,000 and beyond. That's the bandwidth divided into the center frequency. It can be a very narrow circuit, highly selective. And so properly assembled quartz crystals assembled into the right kind of a network can make an extremely high performance filter. Let me drop. Okay, that can make an extremely high performance filter where when you now take a signal generator and go one frequency at a time, you go to each individual frequency and you measure for 1 volt going in how many volts comes out of the filter, and you make a graph of that, you'll recognize it as a what they call a brick wall filter. In other words, if you want the filter to be 2 kilohertz wide at a center frequency of 455 KC, you'll see this rectangular shaped object on your graph when you plot the individual performance, the response of the filter at each one of those frequencies. As you make a graph out of it, it'll have a very steep skirt on the left-hand side, a nice flat top across the top, which is 2 kilohertz wide, another skirt, a very steep skirt on the right-hand side, and very little response anywhere else. Properly designed, filters can do an awful lot of magic. And to design filters, to study the way filters are designed, filter synthesis, there are people who have spent a good fraction of a lifetime coming up with the mathematics in order to make an optimum filter with the available inductors and capacitors. That's a whole art and science in itself, properly designing filters. But without filters, our radios would have nowhere near the performance that we would desire. Very handy things to learn about. I didn't say they're simple, but they're very, very useful. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure that'll put him well on his way to understanding how that goes. Also, I may mention that the filters can be used as passive, or they can be used as traps. Maybe you want to touch on that.
Yeah, up to now I've been describing a band pass filter, a filter that will pass a desirable set of frequencies and reject all others. That's a band pass filter. There's also something called a band stop filter. I can build a filter which passes all frequencies, but a selected group of frequencies don't pass through the filter. So it can be a band stop filter. I can build a filter that passes all frequencies from very low to very high, but stops a 2 kilohertz wide chunk of frequencies at 455 KC. I can create a notch in the pass band. That's a band stop filter. There's also filters called low pass and high pass. I can design a filter which passes everything from DC up to 455 KC, then it rolls off and passes nothing at higher frequencies. That's a low pass filter. And the opposite is a high pass filter. By properly assembling a high pass filter and a low pass filter, you can synthesize a band pass filter. Up till now, all the filters I've been describing are thoroughly passive. You're using resistors, inductors, capacitors, and pieces of quartz crystal resonators. There are ways of using an operational amplifier buried in the middle of a filter where you can make the filter have gain. You can also use the operational amplifier to synthesize components that are unrealizable. If my particular filter design needed a 5 Henry filter, a 5 Henry filter by normal physical construction would be a slightly large, massive object. But there's a way I can set up a operational amplifier with the right kind of a RC, radio and a resistor, capacitor, feedback network around the operational amplifier, and I can synthesize, I can make it act like a 5 Henry filter, even though on the printed circuit board it is a couple of millimeters square thing, if you know what I mean. So once you start adding operational amplifiers to a filter of any kind, band pass, band stop, low pass, high pass, those are the general kinds of filters, you start adding operational amplifiers and you look up something called Salenkey filter, S-A-L-E-N-K-E-Y, I think is the, it's a hyphenated name, but it sounds like Salenkey. You look up Salenkey operational amplifier filters by Google and Wikipedia, and you'll find there's a zillion ways you can add very inexpensive circuits. I mean, nowadays, the bubble pack at Radio Shack will sell you an operational amplifier for 35 cents, which has got 100 and some odd dB of gain inside. You properly use that as an audio bandpass filter, you'll be amazed what response what extremely high performance response you can get out of that when you hook it up to the right when you hook it up to the right kind of circuit. So filters are a fairly deep subject, worth learning, very useful, and boy, there's lots of kinds of filters, passive, active, and so on. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yes, that suggestion is a very strong suggestion. He has several filters that he listed here, and I suggest that he put some signals into them and make some measurements, and I'm sure he can learn a lot and have a lot of fun with it. Okay, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
One last thing I'm going to mention, John. The ultimate in very sophisticated filters is the duplexing filter that's used on a repeater. The repeater you're listening to right now probably has a cavity resonator filter assembly that consists of six individual cavity resonators. Each one of them is probably 3 inches in diameter. Each one of them is probably a foot high, a foot and a half high, and there's six of them connected together side by side with a reentrant rod going down each one of these tubular objects. And that particular filter has 120 decibels of selectivity. It's allowing this transmitter you're listening to go to that antenna, and none of that, let me pick a number, 50 watts of transmitter power gets into the receiver. The signal 600 KC away, coming from somebody's handy talkie, goes through that filter into the receiver, and none of it goes into the transmitter. So in other words, that duplexing filter allows a high power transmitter, a high sensitivity receiver, and allows those two things to simultaneously both be connected to the exact same antenna, and essentially none of the transmit signal gets into the receiver, none of the receiver signal gets into the transmitter. That six cavity duplexing filter, a very sophisticated filter, creates tremendous separation between those two functions and keeps them working very nicely, even though they're both connected to the same antenna. Under ordinary circumstances, you connect your transmitter and your receiver to an antenna simultaneously with a T-connector. The power output from your transmitter will probably damage the front end of the receiver, completely stop its operation while you're transmitting, and lots of grief will occur. It takes a very exotic filter to do that. That's the top of the line of filters in my mind. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, that was a very important consideration you had discussing those RFID tags, which were basically transmitting and receiving at the same time. The receiver hears nothing, and that's amazing.
Yeah, I've been working with those for 9 years now, John. A handheld RFID reader, radio frequency identification tag reader, transmits and receives on the exact same frequency. It's a so-called CW radar. It transmits 1 watt of power on roughly 915 megacycles into an antenna that's got 6 dB of gain. It's a three-element Yagi. That signal goes out as much as 25 feet. The little dipole, which is about 4 inches long on the tag, picks up enough of that signal 25 feet away, rectifies it. That fills up a filter capacitor that acts like a temporary battery. The filter capacitor temporary battery operates the integrated circuit chip. The integrated circuit chip, by a very exotic technique, sends a signal back, which is a 96 or 98-bit code. In other words, that tag will send back 98 bits of information with no battery on board. This tiny little device that looks like it's worth about 20 cents that's connected to the sleeve of a garment is a tag that can identify one of billions of garments because it's got a very unique code. And so the signal coming back from the tag is on the exact same frequency that you transmitted to the tag. The receiver has got an exotic circuit in there that looks at the difference of the outgoing signal versus the ingoing signal and that signal of around minus 80 dBm coming back from the tag is picked up from that receiver. The receiver demodulates that 98-bit information and tells you exactly where the tag is, how far away, who he is, how he got there, how long that garment has been on the shelf, or how long that box has been on the shelf, and so on. Lots and lots of information. And on some of these tags, you can write information into the tag. You can write a whole story into it as to...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can write a whole story. If, for instance, that's a shipping container that came from Hong Kong, and it stops at three other ports before it gets to the United States, on each one of those ports, you could write information into the tag, and so that when that piece of hardware arrives at the United States, all of the information as to what date it arrived and what date it left each one of those extra ports could be on that tag. That's a lot of information electronically installed on a little object that's a fraction of an ounce of weight. It looks like a piece of paper, if you know what I mean, with this fancy metal strips in it and a very tiny little integrated circuit in the center. So RFID tags, you're going to be hearing more and more about them as time goes on. They're not going to replace barcodes. They're going to supplement barcodes. Barcode has only got the 12 or 14 bits of information, and it's very difficult to change the barcode. The RFID tag has 98 bits of information in one embodiment, and some of them have got a hell of a lot more, and you can write that information into it as you use it, if you know what I mean. And the nice thing about in the case of the barcode, to read it, you have to be able to see it. In the case of RFID tag, it could be the third object on the shelf behind two other boxes. You can't even see it, and yet you can still read that tag and know that that particular piece of perishable material in that warehouse, you have just found it, and now you're going to restore it to the real world before it goes bad. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, it's amazing, Dick, what technology is bringing. Pretty soon we'll have to wear those tags on our person, I guess, for ID. But if you're ready, we'll go on to the next one, sir.
Hey, John, good brains think in similar manners. For the last 3 or 4 years, there have been a number of high technology conferences where the name tag you handed to the person attending the conference, because he registered ahead of time or he paid his dues, the tag contains an RFID device inside the tag. And now you've got readers scattered around the auditorium where this conference is taking place. And if you want to, you can keep track of where he is, how long he spent at each one of the displays, which display was the one that had the most number of visitors, where did people dwell the longest period of time. These RFID tags are used inside of hospitals to keep track of where are the doctors, where are the nurses, where is the defibrillator, where is the machinery. It keeps track of moving objects, living objects, and inanimate objects. So RFID tags are already doing that, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
Well, it sounds like it would improve efficiency, but I'm sure there'll be a lot of issues with it. But anyway, I'll go on to the next one, Dick.
Please do. I'll stop interrupting you.
Knowledge is never an interruption, that's for sure. Last week, we discussed an antenna that somebody was working on, and I have a question very similar. This is a 2-quarter-wave antennas that were mounted on a piece of plexiglass, and this is for 10 meters, and they're military-style antennas. They're like thick wool aluminum pipes, about 3/8 of an inch. They're usually spring-loaded on the back of a Jeep or something like that. So now they're mounted on the plastic, the Lexan, diametrically opposed, and he was able to tune it and use it. But he found no difference when the spacing between the two connection points is 3 inches or 20 inches. When he checks the tuning did not change as he extended that spacing where the connections are made. Maybe you can explain what was going on with that. If you need clarification, I'll give you more.
Yeah, the two pieces of tubing, one going to the north, one going to the south, both parallel to the ground is my image, and they're mounted on a piece of plexiglass, and now you're feeding them in the center, or you're feeding them out from the center. When you're feeding them out from the center, is this a T match or a folded dipole-like match? And are you closing the gap in the center, or are you just creating a great big gap in the center and you're changing that gap length without changing the tip-to-tip spacing? So tell me how you're changing whatever you're changing in the center, John. Go ahead.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. These two rods are mounted to the plastic with little U-clamps, and they can slide in and out. They're center-fed. Piece of coax comes up, and one end is connected to the center conductor is on one, the braid on the other. And he just pulls them out, separating, making that gap larger or smaller, and it's not affecting the tuning, and the antenna seems to work no matter which way he does it.
Now, in order for him to be able to pull it out, let me say, 3 inches of gap in the center, sliding through the U-clamps, it sounds to me like he already has the shield and center conductor of the coax cable separated by about 2 or 3 inches. In other words, he's got a lot of spare material that he's either bringing together so it looks, acts like twin lead, or when he pulls the two halves of the dipole apart, he's now scooting the piece of coax cable up, and now the braid is going, is being extended to one side and the center conductor being extended to the other side. So if he's already got the amount of coax cable separated, ready to be fed, and now he's just changing the length of the, if he's just sliding the two rods that represent the two halves of the dipole, is that the image that you're describing to me, John? Go ahead.
That's correct, Dick. He has the coax, it's RGAU, stripped back about 10 inches. So he has 10 inches of braid and about 10 inches of the center conductor. And he would just separate as he slides it in and out, and he can move it approximately from 3 inches to about 20 inches.
Okay, the fact that he's got 10 inches of cable stripped back and he's using it on 10 meters. Let's see now, 10 meters. That's not a great number of wavelengths, I'll admit. 10 meters is 30-foot wavelength. Half-wave dipole is around 16 feet. And he's got 1 foot of stripped material. Where the coax cable is stripped, and even though you lay the braid and the center conductor side by side, you really have not coax, but twin lead in that area. And that twin lead is probably in the vicinity of 300 ohms. So you've got 10 inches or 12 inches of 300 ohm cable, so to speak, electronically speaking, from the coax cable up to the dipole elements.
That's correct. And he's not using a balun.
Now, if he was using the right kind of laboratory equipment, as he extends and contracts those radiating elements that are under the U-clamp, he would see a small change in resonant frequency and impedance, but it's going to be small. And if it really is a 10-meter dipole where there's approximately 8 feet of tubing going to the north and 8 feet of tubing to going to the south, because a half-wave dipole on 10 meters is close to 16 feet long, and he's moving these by about a foot, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can get a hold of those by amateurradio.tv, or also the Antenna Engineering Handbook, chapter number 4. By way of those curves, you can find out exactly what resistive impedance and what reactive impedance you're going to get as you extend and contract those radiators. So he's moving 1 foot radiators that are really tip-to-tip around 16 feet. Therefore, the amount of change is going to be small, and unless he's using good instrumentation, he may not be able to resolve that change. I wonder if that's close to what you think of the answer, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, my first impression is I believe you're right, Dick. I believe I could detect the change, but he's using an MFJ analyzer, and he notices hardly any difference at all. And I think it's the equipment, because it has to make a little bit, because the capacitance is changing, and actually the inductance is changing too. So I would say the same thing. It's just not the equipment isn't refined enough to detect that small amount.
And as he extends and contracts those radiators, two or three things are happening at once. The tip-to-tip spacing is changing, the gap in the center is changing, and the length of the 300-ohm twin lead is changing. So when he's got the two sliding elements as close together as they can get, is now 10 or 12 inches of stripped coax cable is hanging down vertical, and the braid and the center conductor are parallel to each other, and it's acting like 300-ohm twin leads. So the length of the twin lead, the length of the radiator, and the real placing of the coax cable are all changing. And some of these things are changing in a complementary manner. He's decreasing the amount of 300-ohm twin lead as he extends the length of the antenna. And I'll have to study that on a Smith chart as to what's really going on. I know there's a change, but it's not a huge change. And a good network analyzer would resolve it. A simple standing wave ratio meter, unless you look at it pretty closely, it may not be able to see a whole lot of change. Back to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I have one recommendation I wanted to run by you. Supposing he were to mount the elements on a strip line, one for each, that it would slide on to make the contact. That way, the coax could be tight, and the strip line would be fixed, and he might be able to detect the change that way. What do you think of that?
The strip line change that you're describing, John, would be more easily done by making the piece of tubing that goes north and south in my example telescoping tubing. The kind of a whip antenna that really telescopes. If you change the telescoping length of the antennas, now you'll get a direct measurement of length versus tuning characteristics. Over to you, John.
Okay, the only reason I recommended the strip line is because they're fixed elements. He can't extend them. But that would be basically the same thing, and I think he would pick up a radical change with his instrumentation with that. But he says it's working good, and no matter what position. And he was asking, like, what do you think the ideal position is? And I believe if it's 3 inches and he can keep the coax tight, I think he should leave it right there. Back to you, Dick.
Because the antenna tip-to-tip is in the vicinity of 16 feet long, 8 feet to the right and 8 feet to the left, or north and south, so to speak, and he's moving things by a fraction of a foot as far as the elements are concerned, in total number of wavelengths, he's making very little change. There'll be very little change in pattern or efficiency if he's establishing a good impedance match back at the transmitter. Assuming he's got an antenna tuner that has enough dynamic range to it. There's rather little difference on each of those extremes of his settings, of his controls there. All those cases, with proper deployment of the material he's got, he can get 98% efficiency out of that no matter how he sets it. And with a good antenna tuner, he can get a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio back at the transmitter and the receiver. So he's got a lot of variables to play with there. And yes, it's strange, but the total number of wavelengths he's moving a foot out of a 30-foot wavelength. So he's moving, what, 1 foot out of 30 is that 0.3% or is it 3%? It's a rather small number of wavelengths, and therefore the real pattern change and the real impedance change is not going to be significant. That's sort of what he's confirming. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I believe you're right there. Also, I believe that if he had the ability to put it on a network analyzer, I think he would see a change in the queue or the shift in the queue bringing him to a particular frequency. I think that's where he would see his greatest difference.
Good guess, John, but I disagree. When you change the length of a so-called half-wave dipole and you find out what is the bandwidth of the antenna as you keep re-impedance matching it, The cue changes very slowly at first. When you look at the Brown and Woodward curves, one curve shows you what the resistive component does as a function of length. It changes, but very slowly. The other curve shows you what the reactance does as a function of length. It changes very rapidly. But by him re-resonating it with his antenna tuner, he's taking out the reactive component. So the reactive component is changing rapidly as a function of length, but he's removing it if he's got an antenna tuner. The resistive component is changing very slowly as a function of length. Therefore, the real Q in the way he's using it is going to change slowly. The Q will go up as he makes it smaller. But you'd be amazed how slow that Q change is, John. KQRIW.
KC2WGB. Excellent point, Dick. He did not mention if he's using a tuner on that antenna or not. But, that's interesting. Yeah, with the tuner, he can always retune. All right. Very good. I'm sure he's going to have fun with that. He can try a couple of different things, I'm sure. But that's about it from Mel's Corner. So back to you, Dick.
Now, you said you had a question. Go right ahead, John. Oh, I guess we should go to Paul first. Let me go to Paul first. WS2N, what has NASA been doing this week, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick Antulio, could you take me after Paul?
Roger, Dodger. Go ahead, Paul.
Dick, this is WS2N. Yeah, well, not really a lot. There's things coming up and things that are naturally ongoing. Mostly robotic missions, a lot of satellite missions. The NASA site had a picture of the whole Earth, but this was a composite of three passes of a satellite called the Suomi NPP satellite. It's just like a weather kind of satellite, and it's around 500 miles up. And it just made a collection of pictures to try to give it that, what they call the blue marble effect, similar to what they did with Apollo. Apollo 8, when they went around the moon, they took a picture of the Earth. There aren't too many pictures like that. There's one from the Voyager 1 spacecraft that looked back at a lot of the planets, including our, they had a lot of planets at one time, but before that, it did take a picture of the Earth. And that was a blue marble effect. It's an intriguing picture that they like to get once in a while. Let me drop it. Naturally, if you had a permanent base on the moon, you'd have something looking at the Earth all the time. Makes me think, years ago, I used to talk about the Triana spacecraft. It was going to be launched... And it was canceled. The program was canceled in 1998. Triana was the spacecraft that was really a weather spacecraft with involved with NOAA that was going to be put out at the L1 Lagrange point 1 between the Sun and the Earth, and it was going to look back at the Earth 100% of the time and really run a video all day long, forever. And the plan was to actually leave that on the internet. For instance, right now you want to see what the Earth looks like, you'd bring it up and there it is, a live picture, 24 hours a day. That was canceled. They mothballed that and actually had the thing built and they put it in a warehouse somewhere. Triana, they called that. That was named after the first guy that was on Columbus's ship before they discovered America. He was probably up on a mast and looking down as a lookout, and he's the guy that first said, oh, land ho, Triana. Let me drop it. There's still rumors of it bringing that program back one day. I'd like to see that. In fact, it was going to have another one built, and it was going to be put at the L2 point, and they were going to work in conjunction, so you would have had a daytime view and a nighttime view of the Earth all the time. Which would have been nice, but these spacecraft were going to be a million miles out, and that never happened. So to compensate for that, they took this existing spacecraft in polar orbit of the Earth, and he took three pictures. And real nice picture that came up. It's fun to not sight of what the whole Earth looks like. But it's not live. It's not 24 hours. You know, it's not what I would have really preferred. So I thought I'd bring that up. Another thing that's coming up, next flight by our government, by NASA, is something called NuSTAR. N-U-S-T-A-R. I think I might have mentioned it a couple of years ago when it was being built. This is WS2N. Let me drop it. It's going to be launched March 14th, about a month away. And that will be launched actually by a Pegasus spacecraft. Pegasus rocket is a rocket that gets bolted to the bottom of a big jet, and it's dropped from 40,000 feet. And on the front of this thing is the spacecraft. They've had maybe 50 to 100 launches of this thing, and it's always very successful. And it'll put it into an orbit. It's not a very heavy spacecraft, but it's pretty big. It's a meter in diameter, and it does have it's a telescope, and it's going to have this ability to open up gigantic, sort of like looks like a 100-foot tower in space, you know, an antenna tower. It's going to open up like that, and at one end it's going to be the camera system, and the other end is the detecting unit. It's going to work in the hard X-ray spectrum of the. It's going to, you know, you've got Chandra spacecraft doing the low X-rays. This thing's going to have higher frequencies. They call it the hard X-rays. But this truss setup that's going to open up, it's about 33 feet apart. Drop it. The part I remember talking about it on the net, it has to be far apart like that. In other words, you have the detector part, the reflecting tubes, and going to detect, you know, send these X-rays back to the detector. You can't have like a regular mirror with X-rays. You look at the Chandra spacecraft, that's about 33 feet. About the same distance. But the big difference there is that thing weighed like 9,000 pounds and it was put up by a space shuttle. And now they're able to shrink this thing down so you can put it up with a small Pegasus rocket. And with this truss setup, that opens up the space. Like I said, when you look at it, it looks like a 100-foot chrome tower or something, a Texas tower. And one end with the detector, and one end with the optics. So that's going to be going up middle of March, and it's actually being launched by a private organization that builds it. Let me drop it. WS2N. It's being launched by Orbital Science Corporation. And they're the ones that put it on this jet plane. It's really they call it the Stargazer jet. I mean, it's an L-1011 1011. So it's a big freaking jet. Years ago they used to drop these things like with a B-52. Now they use the Stargazer. I thought I'd mention that, and a couple of other things. The Juno spacecraft that's on the way to Jupiter, especially will go into a polar orbit of Jupiter, really study Jupiter, not so much the moon, but Jupiter itself, made its first mid-course correction, successfully done, and that should get there, another year or two. And once that's there, it's really a 33 orbit, or really a couple of, I think it's a year or so mission, a couple of year mission, and that's it. But that will study the atmosphere of Jupiter. But it made its first big course correction. That's doing well. That's the one that doesn't have a nuclear generator on board. It's got these gigantic solar cells. If you were to, three gigantic solar cells coming out. So if you made a circle at the edge of the solar cells, you'd have a circle and then you'd figure the diameter that way. It's pretty big. It's like 65 feet. Give you an idea. So it's huge. It has to be that way. Out by Jupiter, the amount of light you get compared to the inner planets is like something like 28 to 1 or something like that. So you need bigger solar cells to make up the difference to run the equipment. Drop it. Like I said, NASA has many, many different programs going on at the same time. Things going to Jupiter. You've got Messenger around orbiting Mercury. And you also have the Grail spacecraft. That's the two spacecraft that's going around the Moon right now. They've got video cameras on board these things, for general observation. I mean, the idea is really to check out the mass, the different masses of the Moon. But they do have video cameras on board, and the cool thing to look at is to go to the NASA site and you look at the backside of the Moon, and it's a video. It's this thing going around in a polar orbit from the north to the south, looking down at the far side of the Moon in real video with very good quality. So big difference between now and what we used to see 30, 40 years ago. But I mentioned that, and with all the commercial flights that will be eventually going up, there's something called the Dream Chaser. I think I mentioned that before. Let me drop it. US-2N. That's being launched by another private corporation, Sierra Nevada Space Systems. Won't be ready for quite a while. You've got maybe 2015. They're looking at the earliest flight for this thing. But the hardware is already coming about. They do have pictures on the NASA website. And, this thing is really small. Looks like a very small shuttle. It's a lift body system similar to the X-38. What NASA really, really had very good equipment on the X-38, and that was canceled. That was going to be attached to the space station, and they were going to use it as a lifeboat. And that would have carried up to 7 astronauts. Well, this company picked up on that, Sierra Nevada Space Systems, and they're developing this thing, and not as a lifeboat, but they want to put it on top of an Atlas V rocket when the Atlas V system is approved for manned flight. They'll put one of these things on top of it, and you'll be able to put up to 7 astronauts on board if you want. Bring them up to the space station, bring them back, whatever. Comes back, lands like a space shuttle. I thought it might have the parasail system as the X-38, but it doesn't look like it has that. Maybe they will have it, I don't know. But, this thing comes back and eventually lands on wheels. So, interesting things with the commercial space flight, different companies that are involved. It's a big difference. It's a little further behind in development, but it's a big difference from the Dragon. The Dragon is the one that's being built by SpaceX, and that's they have their own launch vehicle called the Falcon 9, and that thing has already been tested.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel. Okay. It will be going to the space station this year, the Dragon, hopefully, and as a resupply vehicle. So, although the Russians have some input in it, they don't want this thing to go. They don't feel it's ready. They don't care if it goes up and goes nearby and then leaves. But NASA wants it to dock. So do I. So that's the latest, Dick. Any questions? I'm here. This is WS2N Space Report.
I do have one question, Paul, and that is the Triano spacecraft, the one that was going to go to Lagrange Point number one, a million miles away from the Earth toward the Sun, and it was going to stare back at the Earth continuously. If it just simply stared at the Earth with an optical camera, that's interesting, but how do you use that information? Was the resolution going to be high enough that you could pick out the birth of hurricanes and things like that? Was the view going to be done in ultraviolet, infrared, you know, off of the optical frequencies? What was the major advantage of sitting a million miles away from the Earth and staring at the Earth 24 hours a day? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they were involved with NOAA. So, I mean, primarily it was a weather satellite. They were going to stare at the storms, hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, depending on what part of the world you are in. That's what they call them, all the same thing. They would have got a good feel of what was going on. You know, you do have your all your satellites today at geosynchronous locations looking at this. I think it would have been another tool to help them pinpoint these things a little bit more accurately. And I don't remember going back, 12, 14 years ago when this thing was being developed, whether or not they had other equipment on board. My guess they probably did, but it would have been a cool thing. Vice President Gore was behind it. So I think you're right to some extent. You know, they could pretty much do with what they have now. When Bush got into office '98, they scrapped this thing. So I think politics probably played a role. I think it would have been a good thing to use to have. You know, you have young people all the time growing up, and when they, you know, years ago they saw the first men on launched into space, eventually the landing of people on the moon, or even the first satellites that were launched by you, Russia, and then what we put up there with the Vanguard program and Explorer program, all these missions, you know, it helped. Let me drop it. I think it helped the future. You know, a lot of people went into science, got involved with that field, and maybe you have today some things that you might not have had, you know, with all the fancy development of the space program. So, something like that. I could imagine a lot of young people sitting around. Hey, look at this, you know. Every once in a while, I click that on. And it's an amazing sight when you see the Earth as a whole. And I think it might have had some kind of benefit that way, you know. I mean, everything that you do with the spacecraft and everything is not 100% designed for science. You look at the 1974 mission between the Russians and American, so-called Apollo 18, but it was officially never called Apollo 18, but we docked up in orbit with the Russians, and that mission itself, not so much value. Let me drop it. By the way, I think the Americans we had a problem coming back. They almost got themselves killed. Got the details on that one, but the mission like that led to probably better relations with Russia. It led to docking of the Mir spacecraft with the shuttle. It led to what you have today of an international partnership of 16 countries, all dedicated to one particular program called the International Space Station. That type of thing. Everything that we do either directly has to do with science, or something like that could be beneficial down the road, is, creating a better country. Back to you there, W.S. Glenn.
thank you, Paul. Let's go over to Rich now. N2EO, you had an additional question. Rich, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. First of all, I want to say what Paul said is very, very interesting. I find it very interesting every week. He really keeps up on NASA. It's too bad a lot of other people don't keep up on NASA the way Paul does. If they did, maybe NASA would get some more funding. Dick, I wanted to give you a report on last week. We were talking about the 432 and 1296 transverters from Down East Microwave and the fact that I didn't have enough drive with 1 milliwatt coming out of the K2 transceiver by Elliecraft. And I told you in the past I didn't have enough gain on the seam on 1296. I'm going to drop.
K2L.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Sorry for breaking in. Richie, I had hoped to come in right after Paul's space report. Dick, I just want to let you know and John know that the documents are updated in Dropbox. I'm going to go back to clear now, K2 Wild.
Glad to hear that, Bernie. Thank you. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. Good evening, Bernie. Yeah, Dick, you remember we were talking about three-terminal devices from Mini Circuit Lab. Well, I decided to call, which I shouldn't have done in the first place. I called on the telephone. I called the people at Down East Microwave in Florida. And they were very, very good. Turns out, on those transverters, they've got provisions to put just what you were talking about. They're called MMIC, MMICs. They're for micro-miniature IC. There are four. There are actually three terminal devices. There's four pins, two are ground. The surface mount, they look about the size. They look to be the same package as an MRF-901 transistor. I'm sure you remember that, but maybe about half the size. You got to use tweezers. They're very, very tiny. Anyway, what you have to do is scratch out some lamps on the transverters and insert these MMICs. Everything worked out. Everything worked out very good. They were very good. They sent me three MMICs. Two transmitter, one for the receiver on 1296, some other parts for the construction. The only thing was they left out... They left out a little bit of construction there. I was going crazy on the 432. It was getting like 2 watts out. I said, something's not turned on here. Turns out they gave me a 330-ohm resistor to power the MMIC on 1296, but they made no mention of it and gave me no resistor on the 432 module. But I compared the two circuits. I was able to figure it out. Everything is working great now. I'm driving them to 50 watts out on both bands with about 0.9 milliwatts. And good receiver gain on 1296. They're a very good company. I'd recommend them to anybody who's interested in bands above 6 meters, 2 meters, 432. They got stuff right up to 10 gigahertz, Dick. And the only thing I have to say about them, I think their manuals are a little sketchy. They could use a company to come in and do a technical writing and put out some better manuals. Anyway, just wanted to report that thing. K2RIW, check that line on 10-2-E-O.
That sounds like quite a success story, Rich. Glad it worked out so well. When you ordered the surface mount MMICs, what was the approximate price for your 432 and your 1296 converter? Over to you, Rich.
They were very good. They sent it all free of charge, Dick. Two MMICs from the transmitter called MAR3s. I forget the number on the one for receive on 1296. They sent the resistors. The technician sent me some poop sheets where he wrote down what has to be done. He did make that little mistake, but I'll tell you, they're a good outfit.
If that was sent to you free of charge, boy, the price is right. How had they been left out of the circuit in the first place? Did you buy the circuit already built up? How come that material was missing there in the first place, Rich? Go ahead.
See, those transverters can be configured different ways. They can be configured to drive with as little as minus 20 dBm and up to 10 watts. If you drive them with 10 watts, they use the loose coupling capacitor, I mean 10 picofarads into the mixer, and they've got a small dummy over there to absorb power. Originally I was going to drive it with another radio. So I had them set up for 10 watts. But I had the instructions. You take out the attenuator, you close couple those, there's a couple of lamps and circuit mount chip capacitors go in there, 1,000 picofarad, I think that 10 picofarad before or something like that. And then I still didn't have enough drive, so what you have to do now, if you want to get below a bill a lot, is there's some lamps that get scratched out, and the mimic shot is right down to the board. It's very high quality stuff. You know, the 1296 transverter, well, both of them have, they're good quality G10 glass boards. And the TA board on 1296 is a Teflon board, which is kind of necessary on microwave frequencies. They use two bricks with a combiner on 1296, one brick on 432.
I see how it happened now. So you changed which rig you were going to use for drive. You used to have a 10-watt drive rig, and you went down to milliwatts. Very good. I'm pretty sure you'll be making QSOs with Barry, I'm sure, on those frequencies if you haven't done so already. Let me go over to John, because John had another question. KC2WGB, K2RAW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, if you remember, about 6 months ago, we were discussing wave propagation in a coax cable or any conductor, and we were speaking about it being similar to a string of pearls. Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, the string of pearls or the marbles in a pipe is often used for describing the electrons flowing through a copper wire. It could be used also, the string of pearls could be described as a radio wave going down a coax cable. In the case of a coax cable, it doesn't have to zigzag back and forth like it does in waveguides. So equally spaced pearls, a string of pearls, moving at the speed of light, where each pearl represents either a half wave or a full wave, depending on how you want to consider it, would be a good analogy. Over to you, John. Go ahead.
Okay, right. It was RF propagation we were talking about. Now, with my 805 slotted line, I assume that if I were to take my probe out of the 0360 position where it goes down from the top and move that probe and come in at a 90-degree position, I would find the same peak at that point, would I not?
The word 0360. Assume now that my slotted line, Hewlett-Packard 805, I think it is on the bench, and it's going from the eastern side toward the western side of the bench. The probe normally sticks straight down through the slotted line from the carriage. It's perpendicular to the carriage, and it can be moved east and west. 0 and 360 and 0 and 90, I'm having trouble. I don't know what changed and how it changed. Not enough of the picture is there yet, John. Go ahead.
Okay, understood. In its present position, it's a 0 degree or the 360 degree position, directly coming down from the top. If I were to take that carriage and drill a hole in the side of the waveguide, the slotted line, and insert the probe exactly in the same place, only 90 degrees displaced radially, I should be still on the high point, if I was on the high point to begin with, correct?
When you say 0 and 360, I'm vaguely now understanding that you might mean you've got a standing wave going down the center conductor of the slotted line. And if you're choosing the peak or the valley, whichever you like as the reference, valley is a much sharper reference, and the reference occurs every half wave down the guide. I would call that 0 and 180. I'm a little bit confused by 0 and 360. But the probe hangs down from the carriage,